it took me on a path that has really changed my life. What I discovered was it was not a small, it was actually a very large world of people who corresponded with inmates. And I began to research it further, and whatever preconceived notions were about who these people were that wanted to pursue these relationships, all the ideas that I had about who those people might be were, you know, destroyed when I began to really read articles about the people, meet the people, talk to the people, and it was not anything like I thought it would be.
What would draw somebody to somebody in that kind of situation? How could you hope to develop anything with somebody who's sitting on death row?
That's a really great question. Yeah. And that's a question that I asked when I started this.
I'm sure, yeah.
I think there are many reasons, but one of the reasons brought me back to when I was a young girl and I used to have pen pals. And it was nice to have a pen pal because I had a friend that lived in a different area of the country or the world. And I felt a connection and I felt that I, you know, wanted to learn about their life. And so initially, you know, that I thought, well, okay, pen pals, that people are curious, you know, and that was part of it. People were curious. They would write to somebody in prison to find out what their life was like. But a good percentage of these people that were writing with the intention of having a relationship, more than a friendship, a romantic relationship. So that was intriguing because that took it to a different level or depth or, you know, it had a different purpose. And so I thought, okay, I have to start somewhere. So first of all, how do I even meet any of these people? I guess that's where the journey began. Once we had the idea and I knew that it was something I wanted to pursue, I thought, how do you find these women? So the way that I began trying to find women that would speak to me is I went through sort of the back door. I thought if I could write to the people on death row and ask them if they would share their stories. So I got a couple of UTC students and I hired them and we started sending letters to everyone on death row, every inmate that we could find on death row. And we went to Wikipedia and there was a list.
Across the country?
Across the country, hundreds. And we would put a stamp self-addressed, you know, envelope in there with a blank piece of paper because we didn't even know if they had access to paper. So, and, you know, I would say, you know, what I was doing, I was doing a documentary film and I'd like to talk to you about your love life. I mean, if you think about how ironic that is, you know, somebody that's, you know, maybe in isolation. but amazingly, I started to get responses. And I had stacks and stacks of letters. I wrote to people like Son of Sam and Charles Manson, Richard Ramirez, who's the Night Stalker, you know, just recently died. And I started getting letters in the mail.
Seems to me that there's a good possibility of being manipulated by people who are in that kind of situation, isn't there? Especially somebody who's opening themselves up to them.
Yes, it's not only a possibility, it's in many cases a probability. Mm. One of the experts that we have for the film is a former warden of San Quentin. And he lives in the Sacramento area. Fabulous source. I mean, he was the warden at San Quentin when Charles Manson came in. He has a long history in law enforcement. And he talks a lot about the manipulation and how most of them, the real infamous ones, you know, will have more than one person that they're writing to. And he tells a funny story about one time he was in the area where sort the mail before it goes out. You know, some they look at, some they don't. But in this particular night, he's sitting there with his other deputies, and this one man on death row, they knew he was writing to multiple women and hoping that they would send money to put on his account, et cetera. So he was courting, you know, numerous women. And this particular night, they noticed that there were several letters that he was sending out. One was to a Katie, one was to a Jane, one was to a Rachel. So all he did was take the same letter and write a different name and address the envelope to each of these particular women. So the warden, they mixed him up. They put Rachel's letter in Jane's envelope, and, you know. So Jane would get Rachel's letter, you know. And he's telling this story on camera, and it's the cutest thing because, you know, he just kind of smiles very coyly, and he said, "I just don't know how that happened." So, wow. Yeah, he talks a lot about that and a lot about the fact that these guys, you know, they come in as manipulators. They've lived their lives as manipulators, and they develop the skill. They hone the skill when they're incarcerated.
What made you want to make this film?
It's, I guess, the why. Uh-huh. Why would someone write, why would someone pursue a relationship with someone behind bars?
It wasn't what you expected, I suspect.
It surprised me on many levels, many levels. First of all, as I was saying earlier, I thought that the women I would be meeting would be desperate women. And
you
then
would
just fill in whatever that looks like, talks like, sounds like, you know, desperation would be at their core. And some were. Some were. But the majority of women that I spoke to had many, many choices. And the women in the film, as I say, there are four women in the film. They're all attractive, educated. They have many choices. One was a Hollywood socialite. One is a college-educated woman, owns her own ranch, has been in the dental industry for many, many, many years. You know, upstanding member of her community, lives in North Carolina. And another lady owns her own business. A beautiful, beautiful woman. Great sister and daughter and loving family. And the stories were like that.
Well, what would motivate somebody in any of those women's situation to get involved with somebody who's at the bottom of the ladder?
One of the ladies is Barbara, and Barbara lives in North Carolina. She had had a marriage that was an unhappy marriage that turned into an abusive marriage. And it's one of those things that started off okay, and then it slowly deteriorated, and she found herself in this situation and was afraid to get out. So she experienced an abusive marriage and swore off men, and did so for a number of years, a large number of years. But she was lonely. And one day she saw a show on TV about, I think it may have been a newscast or a Discovery special about a young man who had escaped from prison. And she learned more about him and was intrigued and wanted to learn more about, again, having a pen pal. How would you do this? Found out that his crime was committed when he was 15. And he was now, you know, in his 30s, had been in this system for a long time. He escaped, and it was a dramatic escape, and he grasped under a big rig of a truck, and, you know, it was this, like, story, and it just grabbed her. Started writing, and a relationship developed.
Especially given Barbara's history, she wasn't in any way intimidated by being involved with somebody who's potentially just like her ex-husband.
The bottom line with this gal, Barbara, is that when I said, okay, Barbara, because we got to know each other over the last couple of years very, very well. And I traveled with her from North Carolina to the prison to meet Jamie for the first time. And so after all of this, it came down to she was lonely. She was curious. She did not want an intimate relationship, intimate physically.
Right.
And this was as intimate as she was comfortable having.
So it was safe in some sense.
It was very safe for her, and she liked her independence.
Mm.
And the other part of the equation is to think of the men in the situation, and, you know, not all of them have multiple, you know, relationships. A lot of them do. But in this case, he went in at 15. He's never had a girlfriend.
Mm.
And to him, he cherishes Barbara. Literally. I mean, this was such a gift to him. He'll probably never get out because his crime is horrendous, even though he was 15. It's a horrendous crime. He murdered multiple people. But he, it's the best thing that ever happened to her, and he shows that. And he tells her that. And he appreciates her. And she'll talk about that. She says, "No one has ever told me I'm beautiful." It could be a ploy. It could be a manipulation tactic. But it's something that she values in her life. And this relationship, at this moment in her life, works.
As it turned out, that story proved to be the exception. And it wasn't without innumerable complications and costs. But for most of the women Joy Krause talked to in making the film, the experience was less than a happy one.
I mean, every single person that I spoke with had suffered in some way for their choice. Some had lost jobs because of their choices, forfeited careers. One lady lost her entire life savings. She funded someone's legal fees, and she lost everything. She is a doctor in Florida who has befriended a man named Joran van der Sloot, who is the primary suspect in Natalie Holloway's disappearance and has been convicted of murdering another lady, and a young lady in Peru. But this doctor became his advocate and was roped into a scam by some people who said they had a way to free him from this Peruvian prison, and she got ensnared in this trap and lost over $1 million.
And then there was one poor woman who ended up in prison herself.
Incredible story about a woman who met a serial killer because she wanted a firsthand opinion about her screenplay, which she had just written, which was about a serial killer.
Mm.
Someone had just been arrested in Los Angeles. It happened to be the Hillside Strangler, Ken Bianchi. And logistically, he was in a holding place in a jail, you know. She was able to meet him, and a whole bizarre set of circumstances happened. And she became so manipulated by this man in daily meetings with him that he convinced her to do a copycat killing.
Oh, my God.
And she did. She tried to do a copycat killing so that the officials would think that they had the wrong man. She was caught. She was arrested. She was convicted of attempted murder. And she spent decades in prison.
The costs and the logistical complications involved in making this film were more than we have time to enumerate, not the least of which was deciding how exactly to talk to people who were in prison on death row. Joy Krause decided the easiest way was to buy a disposable phone.
The first time that phone ever rang, and I looked at it, and it was from a prison, and I thought, oh, my God. God, what do I do? You know, do I answer this phone? What do I say? And, you know, can they track me through the phone? Will they know where I am? You know, you don't know. When you're new doing this, you don't know anything about security or, you know, I'm talking to killers and writing to killers and, oh, my God. So, I'd be sitting at dinner with friends and the phone would ring and I'd go, and I would look at him and go, oh, it's Folsom Prison. Oh, sorry, got to take this, you know, Folsom Prison. So it's been a very bizarre, you know, journey.
have you ever had that impression that that warden shared with you, that you are in the presence of what he called evil?
I did, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I did. As I said, when I was in the prison and I was able to have in very close proximity to someone with vacant eyes.
Sorry?
Vacant eyes. Looked uh-huh. into someone's eyes that I've never seen eyes like that. And I don't know if vacant is the right word, but it was soulless eyes. I wondered when I looked into those eyes. I mean, I had his arm was around me. We were taking a photograph. His arm was around me, and he looked, and we were nose to nose, and it was though I was looking into an abyss.
The film is called Serial Killer Groupies. It'll be shown twice next Tuesday, November 18th, at 12 noon, and again at 6. In the UTC University Center Auditorium. Details are on the website serialkillergroupies.com. For WUTC's Around and About, I'm Richard Winham.